Hello and welcome to the TNW podcast, the show in which we discuss the latest developments in the European technology ecosystem and feature occasional interviews with the most interesting people in the industry. My name is Andriy Degeler. I am the head of media at TNW.
And I'm Linnea Algen, senior editor at TNW. How are you today, Andriy?
Yeah, I'm really good. We just had a long-ish weekend, 3 days of not thinking too much about work. So some time with the kids, with the family. So yeah, it was really good. I wish the weather cooperated a little bit more, but it's fine. How about yourself?
Oh, well, I'm not a happy daylight savings camper at the moment. So I had some choice words when my alarm went off this morning. But other than that, I also had a longish weekend and got some nice rest in. So I'm good as well.
There was an idea at some point to abandon the entire thing, right? Daylight saving?
Yeah, I mean, it's still up for discussion, I think. But it was quite funny. I was living in Russia when they did abolish the time change. But what they did is they decided to stay on the summertime. So in the mid of winter, it never got light. Like in the morning, it just stayed dark until like 11 a.m. And it was so depressing. So that then they had to change it back. And then they changed it to winter time and stayed on winter time. So they don't do the time change anymore, but they had to change from their first option to the second option just because it was so horrible. And this was supposed to be like Medvedev's big legacy thing that he abolished in daylight saving.
Idiotic.
Yeah. So let's make sure that we stay on the right time when we do drop it.
More daylight, but yeah, fewer changes, please. All right, so today's episode, we are going to discuss flying cars, unexpected effects of climate change, espresso origins, and real-life invisibility shields. Yeah, they do exist. And you will also hear an interview with Svilen Angelov. He is the co-founder and CEO of Dronamics, which is a Bulgarian scale-up that's working on long-distance drone transportation with remote piloting. And it's a really fascinating story, so stay with us to learn more. Let's start with the story that we covered over the past week. Linnea, what did you pick this time?
So I'm not talking about AI this week. Maybe I'm the only one in the world who isn't. But I am choosing to highlight a piece of news from the world of aerospace, which was my beat for a few years when I was working for a different publication. Let me ask you, Andriy, how far away do you think flying cars are? Not VTOLs, but actual flying cars that you can drive on the road and then fly, like a BMW with wings kind of thing.
I would say very far away, like as far away as they were 10 or 20 years ago.
Well, actually, no, because if you judge solely by single airworthiness certificates, they are already here. So there's a Slovakian startup called Klein Vision that has developed what it calls the air car.
The air car.
Yes, the air car. And the tech the company has come up with actually transforms a car to a plane in under 3 minutes. The car, or aircraft, depending on what you want to call it, has retractable wings, folding tail surfaces, and a parachute deployment system, should you need it. And this air car has gone through over 70 hours of flight testing and a combined over 200 takeoffs and landings to receive the certificate. And it's equipped with a 160-horsepower BMW engine. It can reach a speed of 300 kilometers an hour and has a range of 1,000 kilometers. Also, it only needs 300 meters of runway. And you can compare that to a small plane, like, say, the Cessna Skyhawk, which needs close to 500 meters. However, it can only take two people.
Including the driver, so basically just...
Yeah, it's a two-seater. Exactly, yeah.
Okay, and what kind of fuel does it run on then?
Well, I think Klein Vision was more excited about creating an actual DeLorean rather than focus on sustainability. So the air car does run on standard fuel. There are no batteries or any hybrid systems installed. So the car took its maiden flight already in 2020. And the type certificate that it's received is from the Slovak Civil Air Authority, and that was in 2022. I think this is an inspiring feat for an aerospace startup to manage to get a wholly new type of a vehicle essentially certified for airworthiness, even if it's just a national one at this stage. and you could basically only fly it in Slovakia. But it actually, I think it bodes quite well for for like urban air mobility startups overall, even beyond the traditional OEMs that have more experience with the certification process.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But taking a flying car from a fun prototype and into commercial production is an entirely different story. So what happened last week and why we cover this is that KleinVision sold a license to manufacture the vehicle, which will get an engine upgrade and be produced as a monocoque, meaning this single shell construction, to a company called Hebei Yanxin Flying Car Technology Company in China. The financial details of the agreement are undisclosed, but the prototype reportedly cost about 2.3 million euros to build.
That's just a bit over the price of that Rimac car that arrived in the Netherlands last week.
Oh, yes, that's true, because that was $2 million,
that was 2 million,
right?
Euros, yeah. So you can choose between a Rimac Nevera and a prototype flying car. I would go for the flying one.
You would?
I am pretty sure I would.
All right. Yeah, I have to say, I mean, you would be one of the first people to own a flying car, whereas the Rimac is, I mean, it's a hypercar, and there are several of those out there. So, yeah, in terms of novelty and fun, pure fun, yeah.
Yeah, but okay, so but if we think about it in more like applied and hands-on terms, what could be the actual commercial market for a flying car?
Well, I have some questions.
Because
I wonder how long it will take an actual like European Aviation Safety Agency, EASA, or a Chinese Aviation Safety Agency for that matter, to certify it. But also, what kind of license will the driver slash pilot need to have? Who will actually buy one? Where would you take off from if there is no specific infrastructure to accommodate it, etc.? However, that being said, there is a certain push right now, and specifically in China, for flying cars. At CES in Las Vegas at the beginning of the year, for example, a company called XPeng showcased a flying car called the Aero HT. So it looks like a car, albeit a very futuristic one, but it does have vertical takeoff and landing capabilities.
Oh.
It is electric, though. So it's essentially an eVTOL that can also drive like a car. But most likely won't be on the roads until the end of the decade, as far as I understand.
So then they will be able to have a multi-level traffic jams in China.
Well, given what the roads look like at this point, maybe that's preferred.
No. Could be.
But meanwhile, there is also a U.S. company called LF Aeronautics, which has received a certificate to fly its prototype from the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. Mm-hmm. And it says it has already received 2,850 pre-orders for its first two-person flying car. And this is going to retail at a mere $300,000.
Which is comparable to a small aircraft price, right? Just like for Cessna 152, 172.
And it also has, this also has a vertical takeoff system. So you don't need any specific infrastructure in terms of, well, maybe a vertiport at some point, but you could also use those that are being developed for other eVTOLs at the moment. I guess you would have to drive it onto the platform. Anyway, that's for urban planners to figure out. But the founder of the company says he thinks a 2025 target for it to be on the roads would actually be pretty realistic. And I mean, you just mentioned you're a general aviation enthusiast. Would you be interested in one?
I would very much be interested in one, but I don't understand how the traffic control, like air traffic control, would work with this with these things.
Yeah, and that's one of the big issues, isn't it, with advanced air mobility in general. Like, how are we going to accommodate all the drones, all the unmanned drones, and all the eVTOLs, the so-called flying air taxis, etc.? It's a whole new level of logistics that are going to have to happen. I think AI will have a big role to play in that.
It could be, but also, like, what kind of certification would you need as a pilot, a driver, whatever you call yourself at that point?
Precisely.
Do you need to have a private pilot license in order to be able to drive these things? That's a lot of questions.
There, exactly. There are a
so
lot of questions.
2025 was great, but I mean, that's not going to be answered by then.
Yeah, no, but I do think it's a fun piece of tech.
It is.
Right?
It's great.
It's sort of, like we said, it's a DeLorean.
Yeah, it is.
Essentially, so.
No, yeah. I like both ideas. Do you prefer a vertical takeoff to like normal takeoff system for a flying car?
I think the cool thing is that it can transition from driving on the road to flying in the air. Like that's the main thing. And then how it gets there, I guess the takeoff would be a little bit more fun if you just speed down the highway and
that's probably take off. I think the only places where that would be allowed would be like Australia or I know in Finland precisely. They also have these stretches of highways that could be used as runways, like somewhere in, like in rural Finland, let's say from the war times.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so. I think so. If you absolutely need it, but I doubt they'll go like, oh yeah, sure, take your flying car out for a spin.
But that would be a lot of fun. Okay, let's move to less fun. Sorry. So my story for the week, a story that we did not cover, but that was still interesting and warrants our attention. This time I chose to highlight a story that has little to do with Europe per se, but it's quite fascinating. So I really couldn't resist. It's not a particularly optimistic one, as I just said, but. It's an important one, and it is about some of the effects of climate change. One of those effects that I've never thought about before turns out to be that the very melting of ice in Greenland and in Antarctica as well, it changes the speed with which the Earth rotates.
Wow.
And that, in turn, has an effect on timekeeping.
Will we not need daylight savings anymore?
Well, yeah, that's I don't think it's on that scale just yet, but it could be the case indeed if we get much more water flowing into the oceans. So here's the news part first. So I think most of us have heard of the concept of a leap second, right? Mm-hmm. So it is a second that gets added once in a while to keep the world clocks in sync with how Earth actually rotates. It is needed because the rotation speed isn't actually constant, and it has mainly been influenced by the currents in the Earth's core. But lately, the rotational speed of our planet has actually increased. I think for the first time since the leap second was introduced, and scientists have been planning to introduce a negative leap second by 2026.
Wow, I had no idea about this.
So, however, recent research showed that the speed of rotation has been decreasing again. And this time, the reason for that was because the ice melts in Greenland and Antarctica, and then it flows as water into the oceans. So simply speaking, this process means that a huge mass of water gets redistributed more evenly across the surface of the planet, rather than being kept close to the poles as these huge ice masses. So these, together with the drag between the ocean floor and moving water, that was called tidal friction. I didn't know this phrase before I read the piece. And this altogether, it slows the Earth down. From what I understand, the situation is not something particularly catastrophic at this point, but it does show the sheer scale of changes that global warming can cause. Like, it literally changes how fast the Earth rotates around its axis. And as a side note, and to get back to more tech-related stuff, if a negative leap second will eventually get introduced, it's likely to require a lot of changes in many computer programs. So if you're old enough to remember what Y2K means, it seems to have very similar vibes. Do you remember Y2K?
Oh, yes. I very well remember Y2K.
So if you don't know what that is, a very quick piece of context. Many programs written in the 20th century represented the year only by the two last digits. So when the year changed from 1999 to 2000, it would have been indistinguishable from 1900. And that was expected widely to cause a lot of issues. So in the late 1990s, it was a very hot topic and a lot of money was spent to fix the issues in all the different critical infrastructure type of programs.
The Y2K bug.
Yeah, it was. I was a teenager at that time, but I do remember it was so widely anticipated as well.
Oh, absolutely. I think we were all looking at the clock change with the mild trepidation.
Yeah.
I would say at that point, we're like, what's going to happen? And then not much.
And there were entire groups of people who expected an entire apocalypse to happen at that time. People were literally moving to the woods and so on. But currently, scientists still think, actually, that there will be a need for a negative leap second. But now it has been postponed from 2026 to 2029. So we have another 5 years. And then maybe there will be indeed a negative leap second and a lot of work for computer programmers to fix the systems.
Yeah, so start upskilling now.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Be in demand in 2029.
Or if you want to take the apocalyptic view of things, you can start prepping to move into the woods. All right, time to move to this week's learnings. Linnea, you can go first. What did you learn?
So I learned this week about how the espresso machine came to be. Oh. And I mean, this is old school tech, but it's still tech. So I think, and also it's kind of, caffeine is kind of what we all run on. So I thought it was applicable for us. So during the late 19th and early 20th century, obviously Italy was industrializing along with most of Europe. And people were moving into urban environments from rural landscapes and villages, but of course they still wanted their coffee breaks even when they were working in factories as opposed to toiling away on the farm. Only the way that they had gotten accustomed to making coffee was in the Arabic tradition, or you might know it as Turkish coffee or Greek coffee, when you boil it together with the grinds on the stove, and that takes about 5 minutes.
Right.
To make. Plus, you need it. If you've ever had that kind of coffee, you know, it's really, really hot to begin with, and you need it to cool down for a long time. So these coffee breaks were taking much longer than the factory owners liked. And so as this was the era of the steam engine, some inventors stepped in to help these poor factory owners to come up with a different way of making coffee. So the first espresso machine was then patented in 1901 by a man called Luigi Bizzera. However, at the time, it did not have near enough pressure to make what you know and most likely love as an espresso today. It only had 1.5 bar of pressure, as opposed to what is like the ideal crema-making, aroma-producing 8 to 9 bar of pressure. But it did make coffee quick and breaks shorter.
Wow, this is really fascinating. I had no idea that.
No, me neither. I just found out this Saturday, actually.
Oh, that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, I will have an extra. I will have an extra espresso today, just to celebrate the human genius that brought us this great drink. Okay, I am going to the field of nearly science fiction that turns out to be actually possible in real life. So my learning of the week is that you can actually get yourself a human-sized invisibility shield that actually works for 700 quid.
That's a bargain.
It is. Or at least, I mean, okay, you can pre-order it at this point on Kickstarter and then you hope for the best. But I mean, it is already the second generation of the invisibility shield. So the first generation was delivered to backers some time ago. So it is produced by a UK-based startup. It is called Invisibility Shield Co. And the company says that it spent 4 years designing the appliance. And the appliance doesn't actually require any external power to function. And technically speaking, it's just a lot of tall, skinny lenses that run the entire height of the device. Can you call it a device? I think you can call it a device. Yeah. All right. So this is the second generation of the shield, as I said, and the first one was financed through a Kickstarter campaign as well. So there is some track record that these people have. I have to admit, I don't fully understand the physics of how it works, but in general, thanks to the way that these lenses reflect the light, the people or objects that are behind the shield are sort of concealed by the light that comes from their background. And the shield apparently works best against uniform backgrounds like foliage or a concrete wall or something like that. or also against something that features many horizontal lines. So for example, a lot of photos that they took for the Kickstarter campaign are on the beach. So you have the line of sand behind you, and then line of sea, and then line of sky. Right, so that's and that works reasonably well. So on the photos, it looks quite impressive. So I will leave a link in the show notes. You can check it out. So, but one thing I was not getting while reading about all these things is, why would anyone actually need it?
I don't know. Maybe have you seen? There's this show called Undercover Boss where they put like a CEO into lots of makeup and then sends them into like the factory floor or. Or they have them spend like a few days as a normal employee. Maybe instead of that, the boss could just bring his invisibility shield onto the office floor and stand behind the shield against the wall.
Okay, that would be interesting. And
I don't know.
And track the coffee break length of employees.
Aha, there you go.
So I was looking for more answers as well, and so I just tried to go through different stories that were written about this invisibility shield thing, and in one comment by the creators I read the following: the applications of the original invisibility shield, so the first generation, have included hiding contestants on a Korean dating show, staying unseen while playing paintball, performing stage magic, hiding small items on an office desk for entertainment purposes, and observing wildlife.
Okay, I can see a few of those. And also, I wonder if it's the Korean dating show that we actually watch at home. Now I have to like go over it
again
and look for...
Have you not watched all the seasons yet?
Yes, I have, but obviously I didn't know to look for the visibility shield, which if it's doing its job, I should not notice.
Yeah, I shouldn't know it's
even there.
So
it's kind of hard to look for, but maybe we have an eagle-eyed listener who has spotted it.
Yeah, let us know if you have ever experienced.
Or if you watch Korean dating shows, keep your eye out.
Yes, so you can look at the photos yourself. No screenshots from the dating show yet, but send us some if you have them. The thing is actually quite impressive, at least on the photos. And if you're not ready to pay £700 for the big shield that can actually conceal more than one person, I think, you can also get a mini one, just like for your desk, and it only costs £54. And it can also be a funny birthday present, I guess, for when the production begins. So yeah, we'll keep an eye on the updates. I have a calendar of team birthdays, so maybe someone will actually get one. When is yours, Linnea?
It's in November.
November. So by then, it
do you
could
think
be...
they'll have it in production by then if they're kickstarting now?
Yeah, I think so. The campaign has already been funded several times over.
Okay.
So I think...
That's a lot of people that want this invisibility screen. I don't know how I feel about this, but yeah.
I really want to read the reviews afterwards, and I hope that they will actually mention the reason and the use that they found for the thing, just to maybe inspire us, you know. Okay, let's move on. Let's move on to the interview of today's episode. And this one, as I said, is with Svilen Rangelov. He is the co-founder and CEO of a company called Dronamics. It is based in Bulgaria, and it is developing and has developed already a long-distance drone transportation system with remote piloting. So I caught up with Svilen during the EIC summit in Brussels that I went to a couple of weeks ago. And Svilen was actually there to announce big news for the company, which we also discussed during the interview. So enjoy the conversation in full and stay tuned. Svilen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So can we start with a little bit of context for those who don't know yourself and Dronamics? What have you been doing over the past, let's say, two decades? And what is Dronamics?
Yeah, so Dronamics, we're in year 10 and we're definitely gearing for the next decade.
Right.
We started with a simple idea that there's a huge gap in the market in the middle mile segment. So what do I mean by that? You have very, very big airplanes that fly between very, very big airports, and they get offloaded onto very, very big trucks. But those trucks do not make, they're not the ones who ring your doorbell. There's an additional handover to small last mile vans. And now, if you have very big airplanes flying on very big airports, that means that actually more than 95% of the world's airports are not really regularly served. So you have literally tens of thousands of communities worldwide not getting direct air service for goods. And if you leverage autonomy and essentially remove the cockpit from the sky and put it on the ground, you can size the aircraft to be the size of that last mile delivery van. So then first you leverage economies of scale in terms of you produce 100 times more vehicles, you need 100 times more components and so on, and get them all at a drastically lower cost. But also you can have direct connectivity on a same day basis to the whole world. So think of a country like Bulgaria, where I'm from, where you have more than 100 airfields, but only one airport that services cargo. So, you know, 4 out of the 6 million people, they need goods further trucked in.
Right.
And that's an issue because it adds time, it adds traffic, it damages the roads and so on. And so uplift by the sky is very, very possible. And that's what we're aiming to solve.
Right. Okay, and you or like, did you have anything to do with aviation before you started the company?
Me, no, but my brother, yes. He studied aerospace engineering in the Technical University in Delft. My background, I studied economics in the US, so we were a good match. We identified the problem. We, you know, growing up in Bulgaria, we always had this chip on the shoulder that we're on the periphery of Europe and everything, you know, takes longer to get to us and costs more. So we were very aware that the further out you live, the more you actually end up paying. And it's an unfair sort of like tax, if you will. But in this day and age, when the digital, you know, economy proved, and especially during the pandemic, people who work in the digital realm can actually live wherever. We're trying to create and enable the same thing for goods, for the physical economy.
So you came up with the idea of having a remotely piloted drone that would deliver the payload from the bigger airport to the smaller communities.
Correct. Or even bypassing the bigger airport.
All right. Right?
A lot of the times it is these big airport service consolidation points simply because there's not enough capacity to go from a tier two to tier two city or town directly. But if you're small enough, you can definitely fill capacity.
And then the question is, how is it different from just having a small plane going between these two points?
Well, our first thought was, yeah, what if we put an autopilot on an airplane? Would this do the job? Very quickly, we found out no. First, it's been done before, and even, you know, 15 years ago or even before that, and you don't have these pilotless airplanes flying around. The reasons are fundamental. First, a lot of those aircraft were designed around the Second World War. So you're betting on a technology that's is like 60, 70 years old, designed with a lot of with all the knowledge that was up until then. Then it was also designed to always carry humans on board, whether passengers or the crew. And to accommodate life on board, you actually add an order of magnitude of complexity. You have a lot more parts. It's not just the weight of the pilot and the cockpit, but it's also, you know, all these hundreds and thousands of parts that you need to carry and service and certify and so on.
Right.
And then the other piece is cargo is really different volume than humans, right? And aircraft being designed always for humans first and not for cargo, that meant that in the current world of e-commerce and, you know, boxes and so on, an airplane able to carry 20 tons actually takes off with 12 because they cannot fit anything more. So all these things, you know, point us, hey, let's start with a clean sheet design and make sure we question every tenet along the way to make sure we're super optimized.
Right. But what I was thinking about as well is, how is it, why not just, why do we actually want to have the pilots be remote? Why not just have a smaller airplane, whatever, Grand Caravan, with a pilot on board and have it fly to these smaller airfields with a cargo?
Because of all the reasons, all the fundamentals, the unit economics of that, and that's being done a lot around the world currently, but the unit economics are quite terrible compared to what we can achieve. So we can achieve some flight that is dramatically cheaper, as well as a vehicle that is dramatically cheaper to produce. And also, let's not forget, that requires pilots. And not only pilots, but also, you know, when you go from A to B, you know, pilots need rest. You need to worry about, like, they need to come back to A and so on. They have a family based somewhere and so on. When you recognize that you can still have pilots and you can still have a cockpit, but the cockpit does not need to move with the rest of the vehicle, that is quite transformational, because it gives you a lot more flexibility to just move them like pieces on a chessboard.
Right. And but what I also so mentioned in the videos, so you have you would have these mobile cockpits on on each of the airfields.
Correct.
How does it work in practice? So let's say we fly from here, from Brussels to the city of Ghent, close by. So there is a cockpit here in the Brussels airport. The pilots in that cockpit take off get the drone off the ground and fly to Ghent. Do they land in Ghent, or who does the landing, and when is the handover done to the pilots on the other side?
So there's actually two handovers done.
Okay.
So the pilots at the origin, they're in charge of the taxiing and takeoff and also loading the flight plan. In cargo, it's very simple because the cargo needs to get to the destination. So in advance, you know where you're going. The cruise portion is handled by autopilot with human supervision, but not from the drone port, but from a third location, which is what we call the network operations center, which is essentially kind of like our own proprietary air traffic control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then as it approaches the destination, then there's the second handover done to the local drone ports at the destination where the pilots there manage the landing. Now, the technology is outpacing the regulatory framework already. So you can do a lot, if not all of that, in an automated and autonomous way. But first, it will be a stepped approach to getting there. And second, we always believe that we're building this for the communities. And ultimately, wherever you land, you need to still, open the door, unload, refuel, and so on. You need humans, and you need always humans to be in the loop. So to us, we see, again, the cockpit and the pilots as part of that gateway locally. So they're part of the airport environment, not part of the vehicle.
Interesting. And I remember there used to be these regulations about not allowing operating drones outside of the line of sight. Is it gone now? So how does that work with Dronamics?
Europe came out with a very, very progressive regulation. In fact, it's been largely developed also by JAROS, the joint authority for rulemaking on unmanned systems. Essentially 60-70 countries around the world for 15 plus years have been crafting those rules, and the EU played a large part in that. So when the EU went ahead and implemented them, they kept the visual line of sight for certain categories of flight, but they also created categories of flights where you can be beyond visual line of sight. But they took a risk-based approach. So if you can demonstrate that you can fly with minimal air risk, minimal ground risk, of course, you could fly beyond visual line of sight. Mm-hmm. And that is how we are operating.
Interesting. And how does it work with the flight levels and the restricted airspace?
So in our case, we fly in controlled airspace. And to be honest, that is part of what reduces the air risk, right? Mm-hmm. Because in controlled airspace, everyone complies with the air traffic control guidance. And so, plus we are flying to, again, underused or unused airfields. And that airspace tends to be very, very...
Yeah. No, that's of course correct. Right. And then, so basically it means that your ATC that takes over the vehicle in cruise, does one person on that ATC control more than one aircraft?
Yeah, they have the capability to do multiple ones. And that's really the key. Again, a cargo scenario should be pretty straightforward. That is the future we're of course, it's a different type of mode of transportation, but you have numerous remote controlled or autonomous transportation systems, like subway systems of Paris a lot of cities carrying millions of passengers daily and so on. It is complex and important to get right, but it is definitely, definitely possible.
Great. And what are the characteristics of the current model of the drone that you have? What's the speed? What's the flight level? How does it work?
Yeah, so we can go as high as 22,000 feet. We can carry up to 350 kilograms, and we can go as far as 2,500 kilometers of range.
That's good. And the cruise speed?
Up to 200 kilometers per hour. So
that's like 120 knots?
Yeah, correct.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, with this payload is as much as you can fit in a small delivery van, like a Renault Kangoo, Volkswagen Caddy, and so on. The range is enough to cross all of Europe in one flight, the South China Sea, the Caribbean, the midpoint of the United States. That's why we picked that. And the 22,000 feet gives us enough versatility to service, high altitude operations, mountainous regions and so on, but also be below commercial air traffic, for
absolutely
where it tends to be very busy.
Great. And so I also read or heard in one of your previous interviews that you're just about to do some operational launches in Greece. Is that happening?
Yeah, that's the target. We'll be launching commercial operations this year. We're quite excited. We'll be flying north of Greece, south of Greece, in Crete, Athens, islands, and so on.
So this will be your first commercial implementation. And how many drones do you expect to be there?
We're starting with two drones. We're building number three. So
are you building it themselves? Like, do you have manufacturing?
We're building those ourselves in Bulgaria, but our model actually is to have regional based manufacturing. So for example, the drones flying in India will be made in India, the ones in the Middle East made in the Middle East, and so on.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned it being an open platform in the future. Is that still the vision?
Yeah, correct. I mean, it takes a village, right? Yeah. And it's the kind of, strategic and critical infrastructure solution for many emerging countries.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And and now we're talking still about drones flying on gasoline, so... and because you also have some work being done on a hydrogen fuel cell, right?
Yeah, that's right. So even with gasoline, because of our airframe, we designed to be very fuel efficient. We already reduced emissions quite significantly, but we are working on a hydrogen solution. Of course, there's also partnerships in biofuel and synthetic fuel providers that we have. And with them, the benefit is that you do not need to certify the power plant and the fuel type. But that's not the case with hydrogen. So hydrogen will take longer. I'm sure everyone understands that in the industry. Yeah, yeah. Because the technology part is just one half of the equation. The other half is the certification part. But it is the future, right? Makes a lot of sense for long-range flights. Definitely, batteries are not the solution.
Do you think it would be easy to make the adjustments to the drone for the hydrogen fuel cell operation?
Yeah, that's what we're focused on, to be able to retrofit it quite easily. And even to potentially use an internal combustion engine, so without even changing the engine, to just change the tank and some of the...
that makes perfect sense. So I just watched yesterday the video of the first flight 9 months ago, and you and your brother with very long beards. that you decided not to shave before the first flight, right? Correct. That was what, 8 years?
8 and a half, yeah.
Oh my god. So what's happened since that first flight? What have you been up
yeah,
to?
Yeah, we've continued the flight test program, so we still have to finish that, and that's the current main focus before we start commercial operations. We've built a second drone. We're building number three right now, and we've solidified a number of key partnerships, both on the customer side with some, for example, postal operators like the Greek Post or the Emirates Post in the UAE, couriers like Aramex and so on, but also partners like Qatar Airways. So because we're an airline and we're the world's first cargo drone airline, we have our IATA codes, we're ICAO codes, we're fully recognized in the aviation ecosystem, and we were able to achieve the first interline agreement with manned airline, and actually with the world's largest cargo airline, nonetheless.
And what kind of agreement is that? What does it mean?
So interline means that we basically, cargo carried on one carrier can be handed over to another so that we can, the customer gets essentially one ticket, much in the same way where you can fly to the US on one airline and in domestic US in a different one. Mm-hmm. So the customer, we can fly with that shipments from all the way from, you know, the Far East. And then once they land in Athens, we can then carry them to the north of Greece or to the islands and so on. And from the customer's point of view, you know, it's just a much more seamless process. They deal with one airline, not with two. We just organize the ours on the back end. But commercially, it's also super valuable because a better way to think about it is, you know, Qatar has the arteries, these huge pipes, and then we have the small capillaries that can reach to these. Because otherwise, that cargo, you know, arriving in Athens, then again, has to get offloaded on the trucks. It can take many, many hours until it gets out of the airport environment at all.
Oh, yeah.
And then many, many hours until it gets trucked and possibly ferried to get to the destination. Mm-hmm. We can definitely cut days, not just hours, of the customer's journey and create significant savings.
Right. Speaking of days, can you only fly under the VFR? Rules?
No.
Visual flight rules?
No, in fact, it's, again, control airspace or instruments, IFR.
So it is possible to fly for. Perfect.
I mean, it is technically IFR flight.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. Right. And how does it work with the pilots? So right now, I know that you have pilots who have commercial experience and flew normal planes. But in the future, would it be possible to teach a pilot from the ground up just for this type of operation?
Yeah, we certainly believe so. Mm-hmm. But we still prefer them to have, you know, experience, you know, flying themselves in the air, so that they recognize, you know, the seriousness of this. We are quite a big airplane after all. But we are working on a flight training program together with Flight Safety International, you know, one of the big, if not the biggest, flight training providers around the world. So the curriculum will be based on existing, you know, experienced commercial pilots. But we do see a future where the technology can enable less experienced ones as well to do a great job. It also has to do a lot with the projections of, you know, the demands, the demand expectations of the industry, mostly on the passenger side. There was this Boeing projection that the world needs 600,000 new pilots and it only has 200,000 currently. So the industry as a whole will have to do a lot to make sure they get enough people excited for aviation. Because it's, like I said, it's complex. Mm-hmm. It takes effort. It takes passion. But the opportunity is endless. If you think about it, humanity has only been flying for 120 years.
Yeah, exactly. A bit more if we count the balloon.
True. Okay, let's say 240 years. But we're just scratching the surface on making use of the third dimension. Future generations will only develop if we continue on that path.
Oh, absolutely. And I was thinking it must be a pretty hard job for a pilot, especially since you're using this underused, sometimes rural landing spots. So some of them are unpaved, for example. I'm not really sure if there is a lot of lighting as well. So like, how can you even fly IFR if there is no lighting? And if the surface is rough, it must be pretty hard to land those things.
Yeah, but look, again, technology should be the friend here. And back to the training question, we do see a future where, because also a lot of people, they become pilots so they can travel the world and they can, you know, not be in the same place and so on. But a lot of them eventually reach a phase in their life where they prefer to stay put. Right?
Absolutely.
So it's, if you're in that community in a small town, smaller city and so on, the same way where you can open a business and you can be the, you know, the entrepreneur of X in your hometown, we would aim to have those folks be passionate enough so that we can train them and they can be that, you know, the pilot, the gatekeeper, the gateway for their
community. Also operate the drone port then itself.
And operate. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So they get to see their family every evening and so on. It's like a little bit like a franchise operation,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You leverage entrepreneurship because they themselves can see firsthand the benefits they can bring to that community.
That's great. Okay, so to wrap this up, since we are meeting at the European Innovation Council R&I week, and you received a 2.5 million grant in November 2022 from the EAC, and I think you raised a lot more money separately as well. So let's say, what was the impact of that grant, and generally, what was the impact of this European Innovation Council structure on the development of the company? How would you describe your experience?
So we started applying for the Horizon 2020 program, you know,
before 2020.
Yeah. So at the time, the most you could get was a grant, and the grant was 2.5 million. So we applied a few times, we were unsuccessful, but we kept applying. Like, if you're an entrepreneur, you don't give up, right?
Right.
So when the EAC came about with a new framework, with a new period, then we kept applying again and eventually became successful. So this time we applied for the blended finance, so both the grant and the investment. And
right.
The grant came first at a very critical time. You know, the grant is for, you know, getting TRL 6 to get you to the higher TRLs. And that was quite important. But now actually here today at this event, we just announced that the Commission, the EIC made an investment of 10 million euros.
Oh, great.
To the company.
Congratulations.
So, thank you. Amazing. Yes. So so we're quite excited because it's the second sovereign fund that's invested in our company. We had a year ago a fund from the UAE also invest in us. And it again confirms our thesis that, you know, efficient transportation of goods to underserved markets is part of the critical infrastructure and trade enablement portfolio of any country. So we're quite excited to be the recipients of that and welcome the EAC even more officially to our team.
It's quite perfect. So Len, thank you very much. Thanks a lot. And good luck with everything you're doing with Dronamics.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Once again, big thanks to Svilen for finding the time to come on the show. And once again, congratulations. Now, this is all we have time for in this episode of the TNW podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you like our show, please help us spread the word. Tell a friend or colleague about the show and follow our updates on social media. Just search for The Next Web and you will find us almost everywhere. Our music and sound engineering is done by SoundPulse. Please feel free to email us with any questions, suggestions, and opinions. We're always at podcast@thenextweb.com. I am Andrei Degler.
And I'm Linnea Ogden. Have a good week, everyone, and talk to you next Wednesday.
Bye-bye.